Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach on this Saturday, September 29th, 2018. And you're welcome to give us a call in here at 254-773-1400 if it indeed it is the September 29th where you are. Unless, of course, you're on the other side of the International Dateline. By the way, you can also, if you're having trouble hearing us on the radio, you can go to www.ktemnews.com and you can listen to us. Of course, we have podcasts on our website at tpwc.com. And you can listen to those as well if you don't get an earful from this. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the housing issue in the United States.
Yeah.
Unusual, well, I shouldn't say unusual. It's happened many times before. It's just that it's unusual this early in the economic cycle, if indeed we are in the economic cycle this early. Existing housing sales are dropping. They're down about 3.7%. New housing starts are down. But the big thing is, and this is the market forecasting what's happening here, is that house building companies have seen a substantial drop in their share prices. Matter of fact, they're down about 15.6% from where they were earlier in the year, which is a bigger drop, by the way, than the Shanghai markets drop with the tariffs. And there's some pretty big reasons for it. It's really odd at this point. Interest rates are starting up, which makes house payments go up a little bit. And it also makes the house prices tend to fall. House prices have been rising, but they're not rising very fast, and they seem to be leveling off, despite the fact that the reason that there's so few houses being sold is there's a shortage of houses. Well, if there's a shortage of houses, and a lot of people want to buy houses, then the price of housing should be jumping like a rocket ship, but it's not.
Right.
This point, and there's certainly no guarantee, and there's no solid evidence that a single indicator means that much, but generally speaking, a couple of years before, the exception in 2007, I want to caveat here, but generally speaking, in a cyclical downturn, a couple of years before a recession, house sales start to peter out, and new house starts start to sag, and custom houses start to sag.
There's some conflicting news out there, and before you just write off what we're saying here, because it's important. We're looking at the underlying data. If you look back 12 years, housing starts are up almost 13% from where they were a year ago. However, if you look at the scale and rapidity of month over month from last month, are we up or down? We've been down through most of the summer, and in August it popped up with a slightly higher. We're up 3.5% from the month before. Not in the South, by the way, just as a side note. The South is still seeing drops in housing starts. What is a housing start? It's when you get the preliminary funding to start building a house. And that's tracked. And that's a really big leading indicator because a lot of money comes into the economy for that. We're seeing drops kind of across the board from a really, really rapid growth pace to not so much. And if you look around, for instance, this is an easy way for consumers to check this, is just to pop open Zillow over a month. Do it 1 month and then look back again a month. Choose a small town that is doing well. I like to use Salado because Salado, Texas, is where we live and do business. And then you look at the number of houses for sale in a given area, and you kind of do a quick comparison. Are these the same houses that were for sale last month? And how many ones are the new? What's the turnover? How long is it being on there? And what we're seeing is that the inventory is staying on the books. It's staying for sale longer. We've gone from about a year ago, houses were on the market for about 3 months on average. And now it's closer to 5 months on average. So if you're about to sell your house, number one, know that it's going to be a little bit longer, and if it goes shorter, then congratulations. But if you're prepared for it to go longer, it'll be better for you. The housing market is slowing down because prices are slightly up at the same time that interest rates are up. That means the monthly payment is up more than slightly. This kind of fits back in there when we're saying it's down, but if you look back 12 months, it's still really good. What we're seeing is, just as you were saying, this is a point in a cycle where we've now filled up all of that backlog of people wanting to buy houses, and now we've got extra houses on the market. People are still buying them, but not as quickly.
And there's something that goes with that. If you own a bond fund at this point and you look at where the total, and you're not taking any money out of it and you're reinvesting all the interest and just paying the taxes out of pocket, you probably will notice that it's a couple of percent lower than it was a year ago. In some cases, it can be 4 or 5% lower. In some cases, it's only down about 1%. But across the board, and we've been forecasting this for a long time, but across the board for 12 months right now, virtually every bond index and most bond funds are starting to see losses. And if we, so in going forward with interest rates, one of two things will happen. First off, it's pretty clear that the Fed is going to keep raising interest rates. They've said they're going to keep raising interest rates to get to what they call a policy neutral position, which is higher than inflation. And if they keep raising interest rates, we either get an inverted yield curve, in which case a recession is on the way, or we get a situation where interest rates are significantly higher a year from now than they are today, which would slow things down very interestingly. This is where we are in the economic cycle. And there's, as a matter of fact, there was a good article in Barron's that said we may have seen the peak already in growth in the second quarter. The second quarter, we had unusually high growth at 4.2% because we got a big tax cut to cause people to buy a lot of equipment for their businesses. We had a lot of exporters trying to get stuff out the door before the tariffs hit. And it looks like the estimates we've got for third quarter right now that I'm seeing out there are anywhere from in the mid-threes up to, basically from the high twos to the mid threes for a quarterly annualized rate. And the Federal Reserve, as well as the major economic forecasters, are saying that our total GDP growth this year will only be 3%, not 4%. And it will start declining the next year and keep declining after that. And so just, it's one of those things to be aware of. We're borrowing a tremendous amount of money.
Yeah, and we're not investing in infrastructure, and we're seeing a lot of bottlenecks there.
And so there's a day of reckoning coming, and this is, you know, here we are in the middle of a major bull market with the economy roaring at full speed ahead.
It's doing
everybody
great.
Happy. Consumer confidence is up, and here we are saying gloom and doom.
Right. We're technically not saying gloom and doom. What we're trying to get out there, and this is a hard sentiment to put across, it's a little bit more nuanced, is times are fantastic right now. It's really, really good times. Don't spend everything you're making and go into debt. Save it, because all of the symptoms of us being overheated are going on right now. Not in the stock market. And one of the big things that we've got to talk about here is the difference between the economy and the stock market.
Right.
The stock market's relatively fairly priced. It may be starting to get a tiny bit expensive, but it's not in a bubble. There's no evidence of a bubble there. There's definitely some areas that are in a bubble in the stock market, but the majority of the stock market is fairly priced. There's also still some areas of the stock market that are underpriced.
And for whatever it's worth, the pricing, we talk about the pricing on the stock market, is not based on what was over the last year. It's what is forecast by analysts and by companies over the next year, and we're about 17.6 times earnings, which is pretty close to the median forward priced earnings ratio.
That's kind of the normal historical.
And if we continue to get the increases in earnings that we've seen, which is always
kind
a question.
Question, yeah.
But the stock market is currently, This is a consensus by the Wall Street Journal and Barron's and other places that go around and talk to people. There's an expectation among investors that, as it has for the past probably decade, the earnings estimates are low. In other words, the market will come in, the companies will come in with higher earnings than have been forecast. So the market is already anticipating those higher earnings for the third quarter. Well, we just finished the third quarter. Well, technically we're still in it, but as far as the market's concerned, the third quarter is over with. And it'll be really interesting to see how the earnings come in. I think they're going to come in very, very well because the tariffs haven't really hit yet. The one thing that could shorten this and really mess it up is if we continue to raise tariffs and go into a full-fledged trade war with China.
Right. And
we could damage earnings pretty severely.
When he says the tariffs haven't really hit yet, he's not saying that we're not tariffing people. It means that the effects of those prices haven't come all the way through the supply chain yet.
Yeah, I bought an e-bike the other day.
Right.
And I look at the price on the e-bike, but the tariffs that were just imposed
haven't hit that
put a 20% tariff on e-bikes coming in. They're made in China.
Right. So this bike is already here, though.
Yeah, and let me tell you, I didn't intentionally buy it at the most opportune time, but it certainly worked out well.
And this kind of dovetails nicely into something I wanted to talk about, the price of aluminum. Okay, we've had a 10% price tariff on aluminum imports almost on everybody. It doesn't include Australia.
Well, that's because in Australia it's aluminium, it's not aluminum.
Yes, they pronounce it differently, so...
That's why they did it.
What that's done, that 10% increase, has caused aluminum prices to go up a lot more than 10%, but what's more... There are some underlying issues that aren't talked about very much.
Yeah.
Alumina comes from bauxite. We've got sanctions as well as tariffs. So what is a sanction? What is a tariff? A sanction is a country has done something that we consider to be truly illegal, not just bad ethics. So Russia invaded Ukraine and took Crimea. They have now said Crimea is Russia. Nobody else is agreeing with that except for basically Russian-influenced small number of countries. We've got sanctions on specific companies that were involved in that, companies that have gone across and started up big facilities in Crimea, and that's caused...
Rusal. Which is Russian aluminum.
Yeah, United Company Rusal. Its founder is Oleg Deripaska. Oleg Deripaska is directly working with Russian intelligence. It's basically a for-profit, not-for-profit, government-owned, but not really oligarch-owned company. Standard Russian company, and was very much involved in the business and governmental decisions of invasion. And so what that's done is it's caused the price of alumina, which is the semi-refined bauxite, it's coming up closer to aluminum, to come up 60% across the board, which is very close to what we're seeing in the steel prices. And as that comes forward with the 10% tariffs, what that is going to do to the price of aluminum next month is that next month's aluminum prices are going to be a lot more expensive than they are this month because the supply chain is moving. Once we get through the backlog of aluminum that's already produced, we're going to start getting to more expensive aluminum, and it's got an extra tariff on it. So when he says the tariffs haven't hit yet, that's what we mean. When we've got tariffs on a raw material, and then we have tariffs on a finished material. So the raw materials have taken a long time to get through. This aluminum is being added to this car part, and this car part is being added to this car. Or this steel is being put into nails, and the nails are more expensive, and so the house's price is coming up. We're seeing that in a very measurable way. It is causing the kind of inflation that we expected to see. If we look at 12-month period inflation rather than month-over-month, or for 2018, inflation's up 2.7% for 2018, which is a lot higher than the 2.25% that we're looking at for month-over-month stuff. So what we're expecting is higher prices kind of across the board. This Christmas season, expect higher prices. This is a very big change from what's happened over the last decade and a half, which is Christmas brings lower prices. You wait to for things to go on sale for Christmas. There's still going to be sales, but the sales aren't going to be as deep as they were the year before. The prices on televisions, if this is a great example, we had a monitor break at the office. To get the same monitor, same manufacturer, same model number that we purchased last year, this year, same size, exactly identical monitors, except the new one's not broken, it's going to cost us $40 more to purchase it.
And
that means the prices are going up. That's electronics inflation.
There's a an article in Fast Markets today that puts something really fascinating. The price of alumina worldwide has risen so high at this point that there are no aluminum smelters in the world that are profitable.
Right.
And that means the price of aluminum has got to come up a lot, because the alumina price is pretty well static unless we decide to suddenly drop all the sanctions against Russia.
Or this is something that isn't being proposed right now. This is a big deal. The expectation that the Trump administration had, that the president had in putting these tariffs on, would be that we would start seeing new refineries. We're starting to see a few new steel refineries, but also new mining. Well, the mining hasn't happened, and not very many refineries, because this has a lot to do with the same kind of supply chain type situation. It costs a lot of money to put in a mine. You've got to buy the property. You've got to hire people. That's hard to do right now. There aren't a lot of people looking that don't have jobs.
Who want to work in aluminum mines.
Right. Let's go work in an aluminum mine where we're digging up bauxite, which is a very powdery red stuff. And you have to build a power plant attached to the refinery. And then you have to have this whole process. We're talking about a six-year process to build a mine. And we don't know how long the tariffs are going to last. It could be that the tariffs all disappear tomorrow, because they weren't really announced beforehand. And if the president says, all right, I've made all these deals, somebody's just invested $8 billion to put in a new mine, and the next day it's not going to be profitable to do it.
It's a matter of one of the ironies, and when you say they're not profitable, there have been a number of aluminum smelters that in the United States that reopened with the tariffs.
Right.
And they hired people back, and they got fired up, and they got, and then the price of aluminum went up, and alumina went up, and now they're in the position where they just reopened a smelter that's now losing money.
Right, right.
Again, this is one of those situations where
tariffs tend to have the opposite effect of the intention.
And not only do tariffs only tend to have the opposite effect, the issue of the sanctions, whether or not they're justified or not politically, I'm not in a position to judge. But what I can say is, if you think about everything that you own that's made out of aluminum, you think about the fact that cars are largely made out of aluminum now, and computers have aluminum in them, and you start looking at the broad specter of things made out of a spectrum of things made out of aluminum and made out of steel, and you realize that it takes 1 to 2 years for an increase of the price of the raw material to filter through to the value of the vehicle or the computer or whatever it is. This is one of those things when we say a recession in 2020 is looking more and more likely. The price of automobiles could easily go up 20 or 30%. Now, nobody's going to know until we get there, because it's just there's stuff that goes into the automobile that now is costing a lot more. That's what's happening with, one of the things that's happening with housing is the tariffs that we've placed on lumber coming out of Canada have caused the price of lumber in the United States to go high enough that it's actually impacting the cost of building a house, dramatically impacting the, and then the combination in that and the crackdown at the border, and admittedly the crackdown at the border against illegal immigration makes sense. However, what doesn't make sense is the absence of an immigration policy change that will allow more workers to legally come into the United States. And as a result, we have these two things coming together, which cause prices to go up, which cause things to get more expensive, and people then are in the position where they need to make more money to buy the same thing. And as their wages go up and things get more expensive, it's the Federal Reserve's job to raise interest rates and slow things down. And this looks like it's all going to come together in about 2020.
Now, next thing, I'm going to throw out some good news in the middle of that.
Good news?
Yeah. United States is now the largest global crude oil producer.
Right.
And natural gas producer.
Right.
That's official as of this month.
And that's...
that's a big deal.
I've been around long enough to remember the 1970s and the Arab oil embargo, when the pledge was to become energy self-sufficient. Folks, we have effectively become energy self-sufficient. Now, we export and we import just because it's convenient to do so, but in a pinch, we're literally in the position right now in the United States of America where we could supply all of our own energy.
Right, and in the middle of all of this, you know, we say we're the largest global crude oil producer in the world, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's moving up. It's not moving down.
3 minute stations. 3 minutes to your next
moment.
Fox
There's
News 30:30.
3 minute warning. Sorry about that. The at the same time that we're the largest producer of crude oil in the world and liquid natural gas period, we're employing less people in the fields than we were last year by about 25%. And that's going to get smaller. We're going to have fewer and fewer people employed in oil fields because the labor is getting too expensive, and they're automating the processes. I mean, you can do the same drill with fewer people today, and the technology is getting to the point where there eventually will be zero people on the ground at the drill site. It will be done by machine. Now, that's 5 or 6 years off, but it's only 5 or 6 years off. Think about that for a second. This is not next decade. We're not talking 10 years out. We're talking about the technology is already past the prototype stage. They're building up from there to do 0 feet on the ground, 0 boots on the ground drilling for oil, which, you know, when you think about that, what is that going to do to employment?
How do they get the drill pipe in position? I mean,
robots. I mean, to some extent, it's, 20 years ago, there were people with straps that were pushing and pulling on straps to get it in place. 10 years ago, there were machines being operated by people that were pushing and pulling straps. Now there's machines that don't have straps that reach down and pick up the thing. They're still being done by people. And the more expensive machines have much fewer people involved, and there's just people there watching the machine to make sure that it does it properly. And at some point, it's going to get so normal that there may be, for safety reasons, there may be some people that are standing back, but they're not going to have, you know, that kind of iconic look of having oil-drenched people standing next to an oil well. That's gone. That's not going to come back. And so that concept out there, there was something else that is a big deal in Europe with the pipelines being built from Russia. We are exporting a substantial amount of liquid natural gas to Europe. We are increasing our market share in Europe about 3 times as quickly as Russia is. So there's another kind of geopolitical statement there that Europe is going to be dependent on Russia and the United States for their power. Except if you're talking about France. France is mostly nuclear and they're energy independent. We can go on to another subject if you like. I just thought that was a good thing to say, that there's some good news on the geopolitical
front. You do, and,
front.
There's another piece of good news. The leading economic index, leading economic indicator index from the Conference Board, which is probably the best known and widest followed, for September, came out a few days ago, and it is actually it came out last week. And it's important to note is in the midst of all this, we're seeing maybe what may be the top of the growth rate and maybe things stabilizing and eventually trailing down towards 2020. It's important to note that it rose again. And as long as the leading economic indicators are rising, historically going back many decades, we have seen that no recession occurs for six months, and it's extremely unlikely for a recession to occur for the following 12 months. So basically we're saying all of the long-term radar is saying we have clear sailing for probably the next year. And that's something to not take our concerns about the fact that this economy is probably peaking. We're probably in the late stages of the economic cycle. And to be aware of that, and I guess it's...
You still have some time. Yeah.
One of the things I'm concerned about is, and I don't know why we're so concerned about it this time, except maybe just experience, is I remember very clearly going into the 1990s and even into 2000 and all of the optimistic news reports, and it's different this time, and everything is going to be wonderful, and recessions are under... Greenspan has whipped recessions. We're not going to have them anymore. And then we had a market, a bear market, that took 18 years to recover in the S&P 500. And in 2000, as much as we saw bubbles popping up in 2007, we were unaware of the fact that we were about to have a global meltdown of the... And along with everybody else in the world, by the way. I was just read an article that said nobody saw this coming, right. Literally. They've gone back and looked at the literature and the radio broadcasts and the podcast.
Yeah.
Nobody saw how severe it was going
right.
to be.
Right. We can go back to those podcasts and say we called a recession. We thought it was going to be a relatively minor thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pretty great major thing. It was a pretty great recession, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, although I hesitate to call it great.
No, well, somebody else did, so that's its name.
I would say it was the abysmal recession.
Yeah, but Great Depression, not so great. Great Recession,
so we're a little more
not so great.
Been at it enough decades now and seen enough of these things coming to realize that they're not pleasant, and they do come, and it's been long enough since the last one, even though it was pretty severe, that people are beginning to take risks again. Right now, for whatever it's worth, if you take the total debt, total corporate and U.S. debt, it's higher than it's ever been relative to the U.S. economy.
Right.
And you borrow a lot of money when you think everything's going to be good in the future and you're not going to have to pay it back at high interest rates and you're going to have plenty of cash flow to pay it back with. And that seems to be, even though people are paying lip service to being cautious...
You can look from basically...
We see a lot of people borrowing a lot of money recklessly.
Yeah, and that's what we see happening at the governmental level is a pretty good representation of what's happening at the consumer level. It's that people are spending more. They're spending more faster than their income is going up. So their income's going up, and they expect it to continue going up because we're in a nice trend now. So they're spending as if the income's already up above where it is. And so there's more debt coming on. We're seeing companies do it, we're seeing governments do it, and we're seeing people do it. So be careful, please.
And it looks like we have a caller on 773-1400, so...
Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, I liked your analogy that you ended your newsletter with, the ant and the grasshopper fable. Is there any additional fables that are true to form? I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah. Joseph in Egypt, there's a good one. 7 years of feast, 7 years of famine. We're not going to do 7 years, but if you, during a seven-year feast period, are not expecting at least 1 year of famine, you're going to hurt yourself. You can go biblical, you can go Buddhist, you can go Chinese, you can even go Sun Tzu, where the art of war has talk about preparation at the times of the strength. If you're in your strength at this moment, you should be preparing for your weakness. And there's really, really good anecdotes. We've got a lot of veterans that are listening and a lot of people that are in the military listening. The United States military...
You think there's more than one person listening?
I wasn't listening. What did you say?
We had one caller, so we know one person's listening.
The U.S. military did not become the strongest military on the world by planning on success. The U.S. military became the strongest military in the world by planning on failure and training for failure, and that is what a good business person and a good market person should be doing. And if it's just your own lifestyle, your own budget, prepare for failure. If you have things prepared right now, when things are great, you build up your reserves, you pay down your debt now, the tendency is to do the opposite. It's like buy low, sell high. Right now, things are going well. I'm talking to people that are reluctant to sell out of positions in the market that they know are overpriced. Why are they reluctant? Well, they might not be as overpriced as it's going to get, one. Two, they're going to have to pay taxes. Have you run into this as well?
Yeah, and
it's a good thing. If you pay taxes, it means you made a profit.
We're noticing that people are willing to commit their long-term retirement or long-term investment programs to shorter-term purchases, large purchases, and that indicates that they're, at least at the subconscious level, becoming comfortable with the fact that the market always goes up.
And that is a scary, scary thing to have as your expectation, because the market... This is one of those funny things that investment people are allowed to say. The market goes down. Now, maybe over history, absolutely over history, it's a lot more up than down. But if you just ignore all the downs, you're going to have bad surprises. And there shouldn't be bad surprises, because you can look back and see that they happened before. They're not going away. These are normal parts of the market cycle.
Let me take this out just a little further. First off, I think there's a fair chance, probably better than 50-50, that we'll have a recession in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And that we'll have pretty good markets for then, pretty good economy for the next couple of years until that occurs. I think it'll be a cyclical recession. It won't be severe. It won't be the horrific Great Recession all over again, because I think it'll just be a business inventory where basically there's too much borrowing and the businesses build up a bunch of inventory and everything slows back down. It could be exacerbated by the tariffs. Coming out of that, though, and this is another reason to keep some powder dry, coming out of that recession, I think we're going to enter into the roaring 20s, just like we did 100 years ago. I think the 2020s are going to be a decade of some of the greatest, if not the greatest, economic expansion in the history of the United States.
I tend to agree with
and
that.
I think we're going to see the equivalent of the internal combustion engine totally changing everything. Only it'll be robotics,
yep,
and drive self-driving trucks and self-driving cars and self and the real positive I read the other day is the labor shortage is creating innovation.
Yeah.
People, as you mentioned, people are willing to commit more and more money to robotics and robotics. Yeah, that's true too. And automated systems, because they simply don't have low cost labor.
Right. I was watching the old version of the Twilight Zone, which I like to do, because the original series wasn't done in for at least the first season. It wasn't done on sets. It was actually done in little towns and things. So you can really see what was going on outside of the movie sets of the time period. But they had an episode on robots. And you just said robotics.
Robotics. So, they had robots.
It was a common pronunciation of robot at the time was robot. And I find that quite humorous.
It is. And we probably have some humorous commercials to play.
Yes, we do. We got to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to call in and join us, we highly encourage that. The phone number to call in here is
254-773-1400.
And we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. And Jake has something he wants to say.
Yeah. John Hancock, the company, not the the Patriot.
The Patriot's dead.
Yes, he's been dead for quite some time. Has just announced that they will not be issuing any policies that do not, life insurance policies, that do not include a special feature that they've done on a voluntary basis up till now, which is you basically wear a piece of technology that tracks your steps and eventually might track your heart rate and so on. And they give awards based on your movements. Now, this isn't, they don't penalize you for not doing it. They basically have a set rate for people, and then if you use this technology, it lowers the rates. And there are people that are saying, well, you should be concerned about this because your rates in the future might be based on whether or not you work out or whether or not you're healthy. And my response to that is they're already based on whether or not you're healthy. This is just something that follows after the contract is written. And there's no suggestion that I can see anywhere that the life insurance companies are going to charge you more for not doing this at this point. That's kind of up in the air in the future, but, you know, it's one of those things that if you feel like you're healthy and you have the ability to wear these the technology, which they give you for free, you can lower your life insurance rates. And they're not the only company doing it. They're just the only company so far that's announced that it's true on all new policies written going forward. I think that's a fascinating area where technology is starting to come into a very old school industry. Very old school.
Makes sense. Probably Jake and I are among two people out of 2 million that are the ratio of 2 to 2 million.
Oh, that's a pretty interesting fraction.
Who continue to follow NAFTA. And you may be aware that the United States and Mexico have a draft agreement. The president said there was a deadline of, I think, the 30th, which is like tomorrow.
Well, this is the second set of deadlines, so he had a deadline.
If Canada's not in
weeks
then,
ago,
then
yeah.
Then we'll do NAFTA with just Mexico.
Except that the Republicans and the House and the Senate
doesn't have the vote in the Senate to approve
that. You can't
do that. And also, Mexico said no. We want a 3-part agreement, so we're not going to sign off on this deal. And there'll be a new president who, in essence, also said we're not signing off on the deal without Canada.
Right.
Just
as a side note, this has frustrated President Trump quite a lot that he has to monitor who's going to be president when it goes into effect. He's really upset because he believes that each president of Mexico should honor the former president's agreements, which I find quite ironic because this is an agreement made by a former president of the United States.
Yeah.
So it's just the things that are frustrating him are the things that frustrate all presidents.
Well, it's an optimistic position, and I think it's a good optimistic position. We are going to continue to have NAFTA. And the reason I say that is the present law stays in effect until a new NAFTA treaty is
right.
approved. And
it's
the NAFTA treaty
agreement.
Agreement, but still has to be confirmed by the Senate.
Just as a majority vote. If it were a treaty, it would have to be a supermajority.
But I don't think there's any way he's going to get a majority vote with Canada left out of the deal,
no,
which gives Canada a pretty good bargaining position. There's two aspects to this that I think most people have missed. One is we're optimistic it's going to work, but two, how devastating it would be if NAFTA shut down. And I mean devastating.
Extremely.
Several economists have simply said, okay, you shut NAFTA down, and we will shortly thereafter enter into a recession, and our economy would
right.
take many years to recover from shutting NAFTA down.
If we shut down NAFTA, we would have to throw out the leading economic indicators index because
yeah.
it doesn't measure this. It doesn't measure a political move that
well, would instantly
destroy trade.
Like
yeah.
But what I don't think a lot of people, Jake has talked about it particularly, but I don't think a lot of us understand that as far as manufacturing is concerned, and a lot of people are focused on manufacturing, Mexico, the United States, and Canada are essentially one entity. And when a complex item, you purchase a complex item like an automobile or even a house.
A walkie-talkie. It doesn't matter what it is.
Elements in that thing were made all over NAFTA, even if it was all made in North America. And the same applies to perhaps a little lesser extent with China. I just bought a new iPhone, and I can tell you that the iPhone is assembled. And most of the components in the iPhone are made in China. And that's the reason that it costs what it costs rather than 3 times what it costs. The other thing is, of course, and Apple has said this when the president was trying to get them to do assembly in the United States, said there's just no way we could do it in the United States. The workers aren't here to do it. yes, Apple could and probably eventually will have an automated system where no, very few workers are working, period, which incidentally means they wind up laying off some of the people who are working in the United States now, to make their equipment on a purely automated basis. But we have an integrated global economy. And without that integrated global economy, our standard of living would be lower, the cost of living would be higher, and we'd be in a recession. So, by the way, one of the things somebody asked earlier about Japan, one of the reasons Japan stayed in kind of a permanent recession for more than a decade,
20 plus years,
is because they did have great restrictions on imports. And one of the things that Abe has been doing over there, they should he should change his name to his surname behind Abe to Lincoln. But he could be Abe Lincoln then.
Oh, yeah.
But
well, Abe is his surname, so that's a problem.
Well, he could have another surname.
Hyphenated Lincoln.
Yeah, so he could be Abe Lincoln. But one of the things he's done is he has worked, and it's one of the reasons that, that there's not tariffs against him, he's worked at allowing more imports to come in to Japan. Admittedly, it's a slow process because it's a democracy, and he's got a legislature. He's got to get it through, and he's got public opinion. But the end effect of putting up a bunch of tariffs and blocking imports is that you wind up in a kind of permanent recession. The German economy, for example, is trying to slip back into recession. Their short-term bunds, which are like our T-bills and T-notes, are still negative numbers. It still takes quantitative easing to keep their economy going. Why? Well, because they're largely dependent on exports, like 12% of their 30% of their economy, I think, or something. Don't quote me on that number, is based on exports. Actually, I think we have a wonderful deal. I'm going to disagree with the president on this. The fact that the vast, vast majority of what we make and what we do in the United States is consumed in the United States, and then we buy cheap components that we couldn't possibly manufacture for that price from overseas and then sell them in the United States to people in the United States means that our consumer in the United States drives the economy. Whereas if you're an export-based economy, other nations are driving your economy, and that means you've sacrificed some security.
Yeah, this is a kind of a good segue moment to talk about what is the balance of trade. What does it mean when we're exporting more than we're importing? On the surface of it, if you just think about exports and imports, if you're importing more than you're exporting for a long period of time, doesn't it seem like you would run out of money eventually?
You're basically buying more than you're selling.
Except here's the problem with that, and it's a big problem. It's not measuring what we're creating and buying and selling inside the United States. And the number is so much larger for what we are creating and selling and purchasing inside the United States that it's kind of ludicrous to look at the balance of trade as being some kind of measurement of how well we're doing. Because much of what we're importing is cheap. Much of what we import is very cheap, and much of what we export is very expensive. And we use those cheap imports to create things that are much more valuable inside the United States. So it's a profitability booster, the fact that we're buying so much from overseas. And that's something that's really hard to look at as the balance of trade and say, hey, look, we're importing more than we're exporting. That's not good. It sounds like we're buying more than we're selling. You can't keep doing that if you're a business. But it isn't we're buying more than we're selling. We're selling a lot more than we're buying. It's just done mostly within the country.
We manufacture a product, and I've said this before, that we don't count as an export,
right,
but it is our number one export.
The dollar.
Dollars. And if it were gold, if we were on a gold standard, the world's on the gold standard, when we are mining gold and we're exporting gold, eventually we're going to run out of gold and we're going to be in trouble. But we have the capability of manufacturing dollars, and the dollar is the reserve currency of the world. The dollar is not like gold. It is, in fact, a product. It is a product that is used by China to purchase raw materials. It's a product that is the reserves for Russia, our or at least erstwhile enemy.
Iran as well. I mean,
and throughout the world, the dollar is the reserve. OPEC, no way in the world OPEC is ever going to go off the dollar standard for a very simple reason. They want an absolutely stable currency where a nation is committed to the value of that currency and will do whatever is necessary to maintain the value of that currency.
Yeah, there's this concept that's been around for a long time to go to something like a petrocurrency based on the value of oil rather than the value of the U.S. dollar. The problem with that is that the United States, in the fracking boom, has created inflation and deflation rapidly, very rapidly, in percentages. You know, if you think of the price of a barrel of oil going from $105 a barrel or $120 a barrel down to $50 a barrel and then back up to $70 a barrel, imagine if your currency was based on that. You wouldn't know how many eggs you could buy in any given. What's the price of eggs? Well, we don't really think about it. You just go and buy eggs because they're going to be pretty close to the price you paid the last time, unless the currency's fluctuating all over the place.
Did you, I don't know if you've heard about it, but there's a couple of new cryptocurrencies that came out.
Yeah, there's always new cryptocurrencies coming out.
There's something called BitShares.
Uh-huh.
And it is, looks like it may have a good future. It's based on the value of the dollar. Basically, it allows dollar exchanges to occur over the crypto market, and it isn't priced in and of itself. It's based on the value of the dollar, which I think is one of the great ironies, is
there was the price whole concept
stable,
of
a price stable cryptocurrency.
Right. The whole idea was to get away from government denominated currency with the original cryptocurrency. And it's come back to this because the number of times we've tried this, we mentioned this the first hour, that checks are in essence currency issued by a bank, that they're only valid by and held valid by companies that have agreed to work with that bank. And it used to be in the United States we had a whole series of different currencies inside our country. They were issued by banks all over the country. And now we've come to a point where we've looked at that over the years and say, hey, we need one central authority to regulate that so that it's stable. And every 10, 15, 20 years, we have to try it again to say, oh, well, we really do want currency to be stable.
What is the price? What's the price of bitcoins now?
It's below 6,000. And it got up to like 12,000 at its peak.
So those of you who were thinking about investing in cryptocurrencies back when that was the craze, a whopping 9 months
in
ago
November,
or so.
November, yeah. Oh, it's at 6,500 at this
okay.
point.
Okay. Basically, it's dropped by 50%. And one of the things that...
More than... It was up to 17,000.
Okay, so it's dropped by
19,000 two-thirds. 19,000 at its
peak. Dropped by two-thirds.
December of 2017, it was at
19,700. And so the point is that it's very similar to gold. I remember when I was seeing the advertisements on Fox that gold could go through $2,000 an ounce, and now the advertisement should be gold could drop to $1,000 an ounce easily because it keeps sliding downhill. One of the things you should recognize is when it comes to currencies and when it comes to store of value, probably the best one in the world is the dollar, and you should be really happy about that.
And we're about out of time for this week. If you if you've enjoyed this, if you want to talk to us in person about your investments, we do offer personalized fiduciary investment advice through the Personal Wealth Coach. And the phone number is to call for that locally.
254-947-1111.
You can reach that same number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. There's podcasts of this program, and you can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. Thank you for listening. Until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.